Yeah, I think most people are here, at least in the body. Now, please come here in your mind to attend this morning's talk, because this morning's talk is going to be on mindfulness, and it's what it really is and how it works on the path of meditation. As you all know by now, that sometimes you have a good understanding of what the instructions are, but then sometimes one goes into the bad habits and one just loses it. One loses one's mindfulness. One can spend hours just allowing the mind to wander off, or sometimes one doesn't know really where one is. The mind is dull, there's nothing really much going on, and there's no progress in the meditation. The mindfulness has to be part of successful meditation, and especially when I talk about those deep states. Although sometimes people say, are they sorts of trances? Are you just disappearing? Just, I couldn't feel anything for a couple of hours. Was that in jhana? I said, no, you're in your bed at night time. That's not jhanas. The point is that to understand the deep meditations are not a dulling of mindfulness, but an empowering of it. So the one is even sharper. It's just sometimes the object of the mindfulness is a bit strange. And because it's strange, one can't recognize it. But after a while, you realize that, wow, you were very fully mindful. And one of the ways of distinguishing between those deep states of mindfulness and states of sloth and torpor, a rule of thumb which is generally pretty accurate, is how you feel afterwards when you come out. If you are still dull when you come out of those states of stillness, it wasn't any deep meditation at all, you just lost your mindfulness. But if afterwards you come out, you feel light, full of energy, very sharp, it's usually the case that you've got to a still state. Not a jhana, because the jhanas you know for sure, because they're huge states of blisses. But the mindfulness is important. And so, in all the Buddhist traditions, we've made a lot about mindfulness. And actually the word is sati, and anyone who knows Pali can actually recognize that that has a dual meaning. Sati, it means like when you're there. It's a locative of the present participle of to be. When this is, it literally means. And it's a fascinating to make that connection, even though it may not be so etymologically correct. Literally, when you're mindful, you're there. When you're not mindful, you're just out with the fairies somewhere. And so it's important, if anyone is committed to the pursuit of truth, to finding reality, that we practice this being here. And because that makes it very clear what mindfulness is, we can understand also what mindfulness isn't. Which is why that I keep on making that point, that when the mind just goes lingering in the past, projects onto the future, or starts thinking, you aren't really being mindful. Once you know what mindfulness is, you know, just this awareness of what's happening, without reacting, just to knowing. Well, I've recently coined the term unconditional mindfulness, because sometimes we use that word unconditional just for loving kindness. And everyone knows unconditional loving kindness. May all beings be happy and well, no matter who they are, no matter what they've done to me. But now we're calling it unconditional mindfulness, which means whatever you're aware of, whatever it is, you are aware of it without trying to get rid of it, hold on to it, or do anything with it whatsoever. Whatever it is, the painful, the pleasant, the good, the ugly, whatever, you allow it to be with full mindfulness. You don't put any demands on what you're aware of. It's the demanding in our meditation which causes the problem. It causes the restlessness and the eventual weakening of mindfulness. Which is why those of you who are here this morning or yesterday evening, you know that part of the Metta Sutra is not being demanding in nature. Have you been demanding when you're meditating? I demand a bit of peace and quiet. I demand sort of jhanas. I demand enlightenment. I pay $300 for this. I want enlightenment. I demand it on my money back. Don't be demanding in nature. In other words, one is mindful unconditionally. whatever this is, even if it's the worst depression you've ever had in your whole existence, unconditional mindfulness of it. Whatever it is, the deepest pain, just be mindful, unconditionally. You find that just that word unconditional, again, disengages the self from what you're experiencing. The self has to control things, put conditions on it, manipulate it. The unconditional aspect of it is another way of saying to let go. So the mindfulness is not just knowing what's going on, but knowing what's going on without doing anything about it. Unconditionally, acceptance, knowing. Which is why that another way of mentioning this mindfulness is like combining it with metta, the door of my heart is open to this moment. Sometimes I can't tell the difference between metta and present moment awareness. Which is why I said yesterday that all these types of meditation are exactly the same. You know, I might try Anapanasati, you can't do that, I say, well, do breath meditation instead. You can't do breath meditation, I do metta meditation, loving. If you can't do metta meditation, then try loving kindness meditation. If you can't try loving kindness meditation, do letting go meditation. If you can't go letting go meditation, just do nothing. If you can't just do nothing, just allow things to be. If you can't allow things to be, just do unconditional mindfulness. If you can't do unconditional mindfulness, then we'll try Anapanasati again. And all I'm doing is just tricking you, I'm being honest about this, to do exactly the same thing. There's only one method of meditation. You just give it different names, come from different angles. So when you say, like, to this present moment, the door of my heart's open to this, no matter what it is, what I'm experiencing, cold, heat, whatever, boredom, the door of my heart's open, you are now practicing mindfulness, unconditional mindfulness. You're opening your mind, your heart, to what's happening now. That's the only way we can develop mindfulness. We can't have selective mindfulness. I'll be mindful of what I like, what I don't like, I'll blot out or chase away. That's not real mindfulness. When you select, you're not really seeing what's there. You're only seeing what you want to see, what you like to see. It's selective mindfulness. And it's the same when you get into the hindrance of ill will. You don't really see what's there. You just see all the faults. That's the nature of you got ill will. You want to justify your mood. This meditation retreat really does suck. And once you start thinking like that, wow, you can see all the reasons why it really sucks. And when you actually start to see these things, you get into this mood. It's not unconditional mindfulness anymore. You're just seeing what you want to see. You're fulfilling your moods. You're justifying your position. And you're selecting what you're aware of. So our unconditional mindfulness has to be mindfulness which is free of those first two hindrances. If there is any desire or ill will, you are bending reality to suit yourself. And you're not seeing things as they truly are. The mindfulness is not being pure. It's not unconditional. You've got conditions on it. It's got riders. You're only seeing, being mindful of what you want to see. And you're being blind to what you can't see. That blindness is a very strange thing. And it's called avijja, it's called delusion. And the incredible thing about delusion is you never know you're deluded. You can't see it. The only thing you can find out is that you were deluded. At the time you think you're right. And the whole history of, you know, human beings, and your history as well, is a category, a whole list of thinking you were right and later on finding you were completely wrong. Mistaken, didn't really understand what was going on. That's why we shouldn't really believe our minds that easily. That's why, as far as the Buddha is concerned, and I make this very clear in talks on deep insight, the only things you can be certain of, the only even the raw data of experience you can be certain of, is that which arises when the five hindrances are overcome. Only then are you not bending the truth to suit yourself. So real mindfulness has to be empowered by an absence of hindrances. Otherwise you simply cannot trust it. It is well known in psychology that there's a huge number of experiments, that there was one experiment which I remember reading about, one of many, I think it was in Harvard, psychology department, did a number of interesting experiments. One of those experiments was they asked sort of one of the students on campus, which is the way to, say, the anatomy labs or whatever. Forget exactly what they asked for, but they wanted directions to one of the faculty buildings. And after asking the question, these two workmen came between the pair of them with a big door, being completely rude, but they were doing some sort of work on campus, and so they separated, you know, the questioner and the student, the victim, if you like, with this big door. But then it's only just a couple of seconds when the door had passed. The questioner asked again, which is the way to the anatomy lab? And this point out over there. And the point was, with that experiment, that when the door went between them, the original questioner went along with the door and was replaced by a new questioner. The one who asked the question at first was not the one who repeated the question afterwards. And they wanted to find out whether this victim, this student, actually noticed there was a change. And most of them did not notice there was a change, because all they were mindful of was not the questioner, but the question. That was the only thing which was important to them. That was the only thing they remembered. And they had great fun with this. Sometimes the first questioner was a small white woman, and the next questioner was this big black guy. And the people didn't notice the difference. Now this is what mindfulness can sometimes trick us, because we don't really see the whole picture. We are selective. We only see what we think is important, what is only interesting to us. And because of that, our mindfulness is not unconditioned after all. It is selective, narrow, and it just carries on in its natural blindness to the way things truly are. So it's important that we grow this mindfulness and we free this mindfulness from our hindrances, especially those first two, you know, desire and ill will, which bends the truth. Restlessness never allows mindfulness to be still long enough to really see what's going on. It's one of the other parts of delusion. We move so fast, we try and process too much information too quickly, that we only get a fraction of the information which is really available. And the classic story for that, which, you know, comes back to how Vipassana and Samatha always come together. Please excuse me for repeating this story, because I've said this many, many times in the talks which I've given. And it's a story of Bodhinyana Monastery, so 2 and a bit kilometers up a hill. 9 years I got up and down that hill in a motor vehicle. One day I decided to walk up that 2.16 kilometers. It's not that far, and I was fit, needed the exercise anyway, and it was a beautiful warm day. But the point of this story is, when I started walking up that hill, I was shocked that I could not recognize my surroundings. And the reason I was shocked was, for 9 years I've been up and down that hill, maybe 3-4 times a week. And now, for the first time, I was walking, and it looked so different to what I'd seen through the window of a car that I was shocked. This didn't make any sense. So then I stopped, and it just stood absolutely still, and looked at that hillside, and it changed again. It looks much different when you're standing still than when you're walking. It looks much different when you're walking than when you're looking through the window of a car. If you don't believe me, when you go back to your home, try walking down your street instead of going in your car. Stand still for 15 or 20 minutes instead of walking. You'll understand what I mean. The physics, what was actually going on, having been a scientist before, you realize that when you are looking through the window of a speeding car, your eye does not have enough time to receive all the information. The light forms an image on the back of the retina, but it moves very quickly. You have to replace that image with something else. And because of that, the image does not fully form. I think that we saw in one of the research journals or something, it takes a tenth of a second to form an image on the eye. That's the minimum. But even that, it just gets a little bit of information. Enough to say you can see something. However, anything shorter, you just cannot really register. Even that amount, you only register the most prominent details. You have to wait for a while. I don't know if any of you ever remember the days of the old photographs, and if ever you've developed any photographs yourself. I remember doing that in the science lab. It was good fun because you took the negative and you put the negative in the chemical and you actually saw slowly the image emerging on the photographic film. It took a while for the image to come out. And if you took the photographic paper out of the chemicals too quickly, it would be just too dull, washed out. The colours wouldn't be formed. The image would be blurry. And that's exactly what happens with your retina. The retina, you know, the back of the eye, is a chemical reaction. It's not digital. It's chemical. And so it takes a while for those chemicals to form and to get clarity in the field of vision. If you move too fast, not only do you not see many details, but the colours are not rich enough. They don't fully form. And your mind just hasn't got time to explore that image. This is why when you could look through the window of a speeding car, you think you're being mindful. You think you're seeing what's there, but you're only seeing a fraction of what's truly happening. It all goes too fast. The senses can't fully capture the image, and the mind has got no time to explore it. The slower you go, the more you see, and the deeper you see. If you stop, then your senses have enough time for an image to fully form, for a sound to fully register, for a feeling to be fully known, and for the mind to really explore it all. Which is why the slower you go, the more the mindfulness increases, the more you see, and the richer it all is. One of the very fortunate aspects of such mindfulness is always accompanied by the mental energy we call happiness. You can tell the degree of your mindfulness by how happy you are. Depressed people have got some of the lowest mindfulness at all. They're not really aware of what's going on. Life is grey, dull, smeared. It has got no texture, no depth, no richness. Even the contours are just all worn away. There's nothing wrong with the world or what they're experiencing. It's their mind is just too weak. The mindfulness has been worn down. And how do you wear down your mindfulness? Because you've been thinking, controlling, managing, manipulating, struggling, striving, complaining. That sort of erodes the contours of experience and makes it just all flat and uninteresting. When you are still, the energies return to mindfulness, which is why I don't really talk much about mindfulness in the first couple of days, because I'm wasting my time talking about mindfulness when it's not really established. But you find when you sit meditation, you stop, you rest, you're still, you don't do very much, which is why we arrange the retreats in this way, when there's nothing much you can do. We don't take a vote every morning about what time we should get up or what should we chanting we should do. It's all there for you. You've got no choice in the matter. You don't have to do anything. Because of that, you know, you do become still. Whether you like it or not, you just have got hardly anything to do in this retreat. Because you've got hardly anything to do, the mindfulness starts to arise. It starts to get strong. You literally start to wake up. You wake up from the fog of life, which has been developed because of too much wasting of energy running around. Your car, your vehicle, your life is slowing down. And you start to see more. You feel more. When you start to see more and feel more, the meditation practice of, say, watching your breath or present moment awareness gets easier. instead of actually looking at the present moment through this dullness, by looking at it through sort of these dirty sunshades, it's like things have been cleaned up. And present moment awareness, you can understand what it is, and you can see it, your mindfulness has been enhanced. So part of my job as a meditation teacher in the first couple of days is to keep you entertained, to keep you here, to stop you from doing things enough for your mindfulness to naturally arise. And when it starts to naturally arise, it arises with energy, with happiness, with clarity, and then you're away. You've got the foundations of meditation. You're alert, you're aware, you're awake. And you're happy being awake. You're finding the joy in the path of meditation. So what I'm saying here is that the mindfulness, instead of worrying too much what it is, I've mentioned what it is, but also you understand the mindfulness's intensity, its depth and its strength are also important. And the path of meditation is a path of empowering mindfulness. Mindfulness gets stronger and stronger. And the simile we can use for mindfulness is being like this flashlight. When you ever go out into the garden at night time, as the full moon isn't up, you need a light to find out where you're going. And these days I've seen these flashlights with I don't know how many batteries in them. They're almost as strong as a car headlight. But also some of the batteries which I have, because as a monk, we sort of sometimes use things until the absolute limit. When other people throw things away, that's when I keep them. When I was a monk in Thailand, I used to get tea bags. I'd make a cup of tea, and then I'd squeeze it out, and then I'd put the tea bag on a line to dry, and I'd use it again. I get about 3 cups of tea from every tea bag. The last one you have to boil to get anything out of. But that's how frugal you were. Imagine those monks, actually, you could take one tea bag and you throw it away. And sometimes you only dip it in there for a few seconds. Don't throw it away. You can send it down to our monastery. We recycle tea bags. But that's how frugal I was. That's how I was brought up as a monk. And so even these days, I'm just naturally frugal, trying to get the most out of everything which I use. And so sometimes the flashlights which you use, you can see. You can't sort of see absolutely clearly, but you can see the way to your heart. That's good enough. So some of the flashlights which I use are very dull. And that's like dull mindfulness. Because you can sort of see your way, but you can't see clearly. And at night time, maybe all you can see is just silhouettes. You can't see any colour, no depth, no real detail. And that's the ordinary mindfulness. You cannot use that to get enlightened, to see the truth. You just find your way backwards and forwards. It's okay for ordinary life, for getting by. But it's not enough to really find the truth. So what we really do, we enhance this mindfulness. When we empower it, it's like sort of putting new batteries in. Instead of just one or two small batteries, around half a dozen or 100 huge batteries. And then when you turn on your flashlight, just like the whole garden lights up. Just like in the middle of the day. It's like more than the middle of the day. It's like you've got a big flat, big spotlight on just a blade of grass. You just see much more. And what you see is more intense, it's brighter, it's more brilliant. And that's this state of empowered mindfulness. And when it gets to enlightenment, seeing the truth of things, that's the degree of mindfulness you need. When you have ordinary mindfulness, and then one day you have an experience of power mindfulness, you know what I mean? Gave a simile a long time ago of it's like digging a hole in the ground. The ordinary mindfulness of daily life when you haven't done any deep meditation is like trying to dig a hole with a teaspoon. You dig, 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 dig. It takes you all morning just to get a little hole. When you've got strong mindfulness, it's like digging it with a shovel. When you've got superpower mindfulness after a jhana, it's like where you've got one of these big backhoes, these earth diggers. Whack, one big spade, one big shovelful, and it's, you can, in 2 seconds, you can dig a hole what would take you for days to do with a teaspoon. Or, the whole day to do with a shovel. That's what we call, the power mindfulness. You can really dig deep into the nature of things. So that mindfulness is what we develop here. So don't think you're starting out with mindfulness. You're starting out with weak mindfulness, using that and growing more powerful mindfulness. The more powerful the mindfulness gets, the bit better the tool, the more you can make even more powerful mindfulness. And this is what we practice. We become more awake, more alert, more on the spot, more profound. We get insights as we come along, because our mindfulness gets stronger. The insights are what happens naturally when the mind wakes up. When it gets stronger, it just sees more, because it's got more power. And you see things which other people don't see, which you haven't seen before. How did I miss that, sometimes you think. The reason why you missed it, you were too dull. The lights were down. And that's why, you know, you can spend years, whole lifetimes, in this dullness of stupidity, like in a dream, not really waking up, not really knowing what's going on, and wondering why you keep stumbling over things and hurting yourself in life. Your flashlight's not strong enough. So here we're empowering that mindfulness. And the sign of power mindfulness is your happiness. Some of you will get such deep meditation during this retreat, you'll be going outside and think, oh, life is just so wonderful, it's just so beautiful, it's so nice. That's how it is when the mindfulness is strong. And it gets really strong, you really bliss out. That's par for the course. That's the nature, the energy of the mind is happiness. So that's actually the sweet, that's actually the reward. That's the little carrot which encourages you to get ever more mindful, ever more deep. So as we're practicing to get empowered mindfulness, we use mindfulness to empower itself. You know, we start off, you know, by trying to be aware of this present moment, so we can stop. And as you become more aware of the present moment, you start to see these hindrances more clearly. All this thinking and worrying stuff which we keep doing, all this complaining, it becomes more clear to you what we're talking about. Yet you can see these things happening in your mind. You can see the thoughts coming in and going out. As the mindfulness increases, you can actually see the separation between these thoughts and yourself. When mindfulness is dull, you can't see that separation. You think, these thoughts are mine, something to do with me. But as the mindfulness increases, you can see the thoughts are just thoughts, that's all. They're not mine. You start to see that. And because the mindfulness has increased to that level, you can detach from those thoughts, and the mindfulness gets even stronger. You can detach from the past, you can detach from the pains in the body, you can detach from all these hopes and worries which weaken your mindfulness. As the mindfulness increases, it enables you to increase the mindfulness even more. You go on this wonderful path, ever upwards, of ever increased awareness, attention, and happiness. This is just how it works. Also, you find that the mind is more easy to train. When you have more mindfulness, you can actually see the territory of meditation very clearly, and you know what your obstacles are. Yesterday, when I gave the talk on the hindrances, even though I finished off the talk with the attack of all hindrances with an Alagiri strategy, that's actually what people say sometimes, but they've always got their favourite hindrance, the one which is the most prominent, the one which keeps coming up again and again and again. You may have a different favourite hindrance every day, but what is on the menu today? What is the chef's special hindrance today which the Mara is serving up for you? Is it sloth and torpor, or is it ill will? Are you in a bad mood today, or is it desire? You just can't wait to get lunch. So where is your hindrance right at this moment? Every one of us has got a favourite hindrance. And I use the simile of the snake, which actually to help me in those early years as a monk overcome my favourite hindrance. And the simile of the snake goes like this. Again, it's another flashlight story. In those days, you weren't deliberately frugal. You had to be frugal because we never had very much. And in fact, many times there wasn't any sandals to wear. There weren't any. So you had to walk barefooted through the jungle. And this was a jungle where there were many snakes, and all the snakes were dangerous. You didn't have any protection. I know it says in the books in Australia, if you go in the bush, you know, wear these, not sandals, but wear boots with thick socks. We didn't have any boots. We didn't have any sandals. There's no socks, just your bare feet. And the snakes were all around, and they were poisonous, venomous, dangerous. So you're okay if you had a flashlight, because you could see your way through the forest and you could avoid the snakes. But what happened when your flashlight batteries died and you didn't have any light to find your way back to your huts? And that's what we used to do. We used to meditate in the hall or go listen to a talk by Ajahn Chah, and after the talk, back to your hut. And there you had to negotiate your way through the forest full of snakes back to your room without a flashlight, with no sandals. Now, I never got bitten by any snake, and the reason was because I was always alert to the danger. I knew those snakes were around. I had no shoes, no flashlight. I was very vulnerable, so I was on the lookout from the moment I left that main hall until the moment I got to the safety of my hut. I was always looking on that path. And even though you couldn't actually see the snake, you see, it was just like a dark shape across the path. It could have been a stick, it could have been a snake, but I was taking no chances. I couldn't see. So I'd either go in a different direction, do a detour, or just leap over it quickly. And that way I never got bitten, even without any flashlight. The point was, I used my mindfulness, my alertness, from the very beginning. This is how you meditate. If you've got a particular hindrance which is always bothering you, restlessness, despair, no force, will, whatever it is your special hindrance, before you start on the journey of meditation, tell yourself, this is the one I've got to look out for. At the very beginning, this is the dangerous snake which has strangled my progress, which has poisoned my meditation practice. I've got to look out for this one. And if you have that degree of mindfulness from the beginning, you've told yourself what to be aware of, you find as you're walking the path of meditation, say the snake of sloth and torpor is about to strangle you. You see it before it gets to you. It may be like restlessness. You see it before it comes. It might be fault finding. You're about to be fault finding. I've seen that. I've trod on that so many times. No way this time. You leap over it. You go by another way. When you tell yourself what the problem's going to be, or the big danger, you'll find you'll always ward it off. You'd always avoid it. So this is where we start using what I've called programming our mindfulness. You remind yourself at the very beginning what the danger to your meditation is. At the very beginning of your meditation, this is the one I've got to look out for. It could be, for example, that sometimes people have the problem, they're watching their breath, and they can watch their breath for a while, but then it just disappears and they get lost. They don't know what they're doing. You can actually program your mindfulness. When I'm watching the breath, I will stay with the breath until it gets really beautiful. I will not let it go until it's full of joy. I will not let the breath go until it's full of joy. I will not let the breath go until it's full of joy. I usually program my mindfulness by repeating something very clearly 3 times. I use the 3 times method because that reinforces it, and then I forget about it. It works so incredibly well. All I need to do is just do that, and then I'm just meditating, and you maybe say, I'm just using this as an example, you're watching the breath and usually it will just slip away and you go into some dull state. Just as it's about to do that, the new program comes in. What you've told your mindfulness to do just activates, and you don't let the breath go. At that moment, it's not an effort of will. The will was done earlier. It becomes an automatic process, and it's wonderful to watch. You guide the meditation without controlling it. You let go of the manipulating mind, but it still goes in the direction which you've programmed it. The Buddha called mindfulness the gatekeeper. It guards the mind. It lets in what is supposed to be let in, and it keeps out what's supposed to be let out, kept out. That mindfulness, when it gets programmed well, is like a very well-instructed gatekeeper. But if you've got a gatekeeper, the most important thing is to give them clear instructions. So when you instruct your mindfulness, make it very clear so your mindfulness knows exactly what it's supposed to be doing. Many of you are experienced managers. You know that if you have staff working for you, the most important thing is for you to tell them quite clearly what their task is, when they're supposed to complete it by. If you don't give clear instructions, your staff get very confused and you never get the job done. A good manager can actually speak clearly and make it very precise what is expected, and then there's no job confusion. Think of your gatekeeper like one of your staff. Tell them the job. They're very willing to do the job. They only want to know what you want them to do. And a lot of times in meditation it never works because you do not give clear instructions. You don't know what you're supposed to be doing. So just tell them, oh, just sit there and be mindful. And it just goes and falls asleep. So it doesn't know what it's supposed to be doing. So with mindfulness, try programming the mindfulness at the very beginning of your meditation. Find out your biggest hindrance and tell, look, this is the one you've got to look out for, gatekeeper. Make it very precise. Don't get stuck in that. At first, it's not so powerful because the mindfulness is weak. As the mindfulness progresses throughout this meditation retreat, the programming of mindfulness gets even more powerful. The old trick which I encourage people to use is that when you go to bed tonight, just to tell yourself, I will wake up whatever time you want to wake up. Say you want to come for the morning chanting. I will wake up at 5 to 6. I will wake up at 5 to 6. I will wake up at 5 to 6. Repeat it 3 times. Don't even worry about setting your alarm. See if it works. As soon as you just set your internal alarm, you program your mindfulness, just go to sleep. And you'll be stunned. You'll wake up and it's 1 or 2 minutes either side of the time you set. It's much more efficient than an alarm clock. An alarm clock, you've got a snooze button. In programming mindfulness, there's no snooze button. You just wake up and there you are. And I tried that on my first retreat. It was very effective. And I use that even these days. When I have to remember to do something, I've got to remember to call someone at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And instead of, you know, tying a string around your finger or writing it down or telling other people, please remind me to ring up somebody at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, you just program your mindfulness. Just make the mind reasonably still and say, I must remember to ring this person up at 3 p.m. I must remember to ring them up at 3 p.m. I must remember to ring them up at 3 p.m. And then you forget about it. You don't worry about it. You don't fill your mind with all these worries. What am I supposed to do? Yeah, I must, can't forget. I can't forget. 3 p.m., 3 p.m., 3 p.m. Repeating that to yourself like someone really worried all day. And what happens is that you forget about it and it gets 3 p.m. and the thought comes up in the mind. Oh, yeah, I must ring that person up. And it comes there because you programmed it in there. The mind's got its own clock and it works very, very well. That simplifies your life. If you've got many, many appointments, this is your personal organizer, your mindfulness. And it works really, really well. So experiment with that. Now, when you go to sleep, don't set your clock. Tell yourself, I will wake up at a certain time. See what happens. It's powerful. And it just shows you what mindfulness can do. As the mindfulness wakes up, you'll find it's easy to watch the breath. As the mindfulness grows, it gets more joyful. And you think that this breath is impossible for you to watch, be patient. Just do nothing. Make the mind still. Create more energy for mindfulness. And when the mindfulness is strong enough, it's so easy to watch the breath. If you can't watch the breath yet, it means mindfulness is not ready. Rest some more. If it's ready, it's the easiest thing to do. It's nothing to do with your skill. So don't try and just to be sharper or smarter. Your job is just to create the causes for being able to say watch the breath. And that is creating the strong mindfulness, which comes about through stillness. So understand what the causes are, which is why you'll understand the instructions I've been giving for the last 2 or 3 days. Rest, do nothing, be still, make the mind calm. That is your effort to see how little your mind can do. Sometimes thinking, fantasizing, that's actually doing something. That's not the instructions. They're still doing something. See if you can just allow thoughts to come in, and then they will stop. Just allow things to be. The door of my heart's open. And then not only will they come in, they will go out. Because the door is for going in and also for going out. This way, the things will empty out of your mind. There's more stuff in there than is outside. So usually when you open the door of cupboards, things fall out. They don't usually fall in. So this way, you're emptying the mind when you open the door of your heart. And that way you're understanding the power of mindfulness, to power the mind into deeper and deeper states of meditation. As the mindfulness grows in its strength, then you can take up more refined objects of meditation. Only when the mindfulness is very strong can you see the beautiful breath. It's there. Again, the beauty in the breath comes from the mindfulness itself. It's what your energized mind puts onto the object. And when you can watch the beautiful breath, you have lots of happiness. The sign of mindfulness is getting strong. Just build up that mindfulness more and more, just by stillness. It happens naturally. It just grows. And as it grows more and more, a nimitta can come up, but only when the mindfulness is very, very strong. You can't make it come up. You can't will it. Oh, I am going to have the nimitta right now. Leave it to nature for these things to grow. And if the mindfulness is ready, you can hold a nimitta. If the mindfulness isn't ready, it will pop up and disappear again. You haven't built up enough strength in the stillness of the mind. If the mindfulness is very, very strong, only then can you enter the jhanas. You have to be that alert, but that still, and have immense power to be able to enter those deep states of bliss. So you may well describe the whole path of Buddhism as an empowering of mindfulness, stage by stage. As the mindfulness gets stronger, you find it can take more subtle objects. As it takes more subtle objects, it can work to strengthen itself even more. And then you can take an even more subtle object. As the mindfulness grows, you're able to do more profound things. In the same way, say a brain surgeon has to start off with just, say, peeling potatoes. Just to know how to sort of cut something. And as they continue, they can take more and more refined objects to peel, until eventually that they're so dexterous, they're so sensitive with their awareness of the muscles in their hand, that then they can maybe peel a brain open. But you will not allow anyone to operate on your brain if they can't even peel a potato. Now, I always remember this story in Soviet Russia, which spent a lot of time training their scientists and even their doctors, and they would actually train their brain surgeons. They give them a test. They give them a newspaper, one sheet of newspaper, just like, the West Australian, Australian or Straits Times or whatever, and a scalpel, and they had to split that newspaper, that sheet of newsprint, into two, down the middle. So there would be two sheets of like printed material, and the inside would be just clear. So, and they could do that after a while. They could dissect one sheet of newspaper right down the middle. And then they were obviously dexterous enough to actually operate on the person's brain. It's the same with your mindfulness. It takes a while to build up this dexterity so you can watch these nimittas. You can watch the jhanas. And this builds up naturally. And the quickest way you can do this is by being still. That's how your dexterity is built. To repeat Ajahn Chah again, you strengthen the muscles of your body through exercise, through doing things, but you strengthen the muscles of the mind, mindfulness, through stillness. The more still you are, the more dexterous is your mind. Mindfulness gets empowered. So this is what mindfulness is. It's how it works and how you can program that mindfulness. You can put the instructions in there and mindfulness will know exactly what to do and when. Any problems in meditation, whether it's the gross hindrances or the very refined ones, like happens when you get nimittas, excitement or fear or controlling, even the slightest bit of controlling, the way to overcome those hindrances, if they've happened a few times, the beginning of the meditation, say if a nimitta comes up, this is what I'll do. The nimitta comes up, those instructions will then kick in and you won't mess up again. That's how mindfulness works. So, is there any questions about mindfulness? Yeah. Beautiful breath. If you see like a beautiful flower, what's beautiful about a flower? A flower is just, for me, I suffer from hay fever, so I look at flowers, not another flower next to me. It's one of my sort of, it's one of my bad karmas. I've had something terrible from the past. Now I'm a monk, people give me flowers, and I have to sit right close to them, closer than anybody else, and then become a head monk. You're right next to the flowers. So I've got some bad karma. I think I must have punched an arahat in the nose in a past life. So I've got a bad nose this time. They say that sometimes I wanted to have a nose transplant. I have all these other transplants available these days. You can have a liver transplant. You can have a stomach transplant. I want a nose transplant. Wouldn't that be good? And then I could actually at last be multicultural. And I can get, because I live in Australia, I have an Aboriginal nose. A little black nose on a white face. That'd be really, that'd be a statement. Wouldn't that be fun? But anyhow, that's just one of my problems with sort of with the flowers. How do I get on to that? What was your question anyway? Beautiful. Oh, beautiful, yeah, beautiful flowers. Yeah, lovely flowers. Anyway, so what is the mean by beauty? It means those things become very attractive, they pull your attention towards yourself, you like them, you have pleasure with them. So when I say the breath becomes suffused with joy, you're so happy watching this breath, and it actually looks like it's very beautiful and soft and nice, you just want to keep looking at it. Yeah. Yes, when the breath disappears too soon and you're peaceful but you haven't got the joy there, the breath has gone too quickly. The mindfulness is not strong enough yet. So when it disappears, a lot of people, what am I supposed to look at now? It's just too dim, that dim. The flashlight batteries are not strong enough. When the flashlight batteries are strong enough, when you see the breath looks beautiful. In the same way, when I was going very slowly up that hillside, even the rocks are looking exquisitely beautiful. There are times, you'll understand what we mean, there are times when you get so still in this meditation, you go outside, and you just see just those wicker chairs. It's amazing how beautiful they are. They're not just ordinary anymore. They are beautiful, literally. And you understand what the beautiful breath is now. The breath is just the breath, but the mindfulness increases. And whatever you look at looks incredibly wonderful and beautiful. Some monks do the meditation on bones, skulls and skeletons. And it's a strange thing that if you just, you know, visualize the skeleton, or say the skull is usually the most common form of visualization for monks or nuns doing this, there comes a time you've got that skull in your mind, and it's still, and it starts to become the most beautiful thing you've ever seen. It becomes brilliantly white and gorgeous. It's like you're watching like a work of art. It is beautiful. Beauty is in the eye of the beholder. No, beauty is in mindfulness. That is the beholder. This is actually what happens, what you experience. So when you're watching the breath, if it disappears and all you see is coolness, the mindfulness wasn't really strong enough yet. Don't worry about it. Don't try and do things. Leave it alone. The mindfulness will increase naturally through non-doing. You'll be meditating there, and the breath, this is so delightful. You'll understand what we mean by the beautiful breath. As the Buddha said, in the fifth and sixth stages of Anapanasati, when you're still watching the breath, you develop piti and sukha with the breath, the joy and the happiness, before you calm that all down and let the breath disappear. So the breath becomes so delightful, you're just so happy just watching the breath come and go. Oh, this is so nice. It's not cool, it's just beautiful. And then when it disappears, the mind has got enough energy, you can either watch the beauty, or usually the nimitta comes up afterwards, because the mind is energized. It's got some oomph behind it. This is where, you know, you see the result of effort. You know, because when you do this properly, you get huge amounts of energy. It's a strange thing, but you say, yeah, sleep whenever you want, just don't do anything, no bells. But if you do this properly, and you don't use it just as an indulgence, but you really do it properly, you find you don't want to sleep so much. You find that just, you go to bed at night, you've got energy. So you get up and meditate. It's nature. When you don't waste your energy, you don't need to sleep so much. And the mind just gets energized. It's a natural progress. So when you say you don't have to do something, anything, you actually end up doing more. But not through willpower, through nature. Nature allows you to watch the breath, not you forcing yourself. And the breath becomes so delightful, you just can't not watch it. It's just too interesting, it's too enjoyable. You sit there for hours just watching this beautiful breath. And that's when you get the piti sukha coming along with the breath. And if that's all I managed to teach throughout my whole life as a monk, that's enough to get the energy, the happiness back into meditation, where it belongs. And then when the breath disappears, oh, this is really nice. You're just taking happiness to another level. And the happiness is powerful mindfulness. The more power your mindfulness has, just the more bliss, the more depth. You ever notice that? If you wake up in the morning and you're feeling dull, so you have a cup of coffee. And then suddenly you feel happy again. Why is that? It just gives you a boost of energy, that's all. And mental energy is happiness. So when you get mental energy, your happiness goes up. You have huge amounts of energy, and your real happiness goes incredibly up. That's why that sometimes people think Ajahn Brahm is manic, all this sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. What's Ajahn Brahm on? Does he go back to his hut and take these speed tablets or what? Yes, I take meditation tablets. Crystal limiter, not crystal meth. Is that okay? Does that answer your question? Very good question, thank you. So you develop the beauty and the power. Any more questions? Yeah? Yeah, when it doesn't matter if it's long or short, just allow it to be natural. The idea of long or short is just to give you some little crutch, something extra to watch. Instead of just watching a bare breath, pay some attention to its length or to its, whether it's smooth or rough. It doesn't matter where you breathe from. So your job is just to watch the breath, not to do the breath. The body does the breathing very well without you. It's always the same, isn't it, that when we don't watch things, it goes nice and smoothly. As soon as you start watching it, you mess it up. For example, now become aware of the saliva in your throat or in your mouth. Until I said that, it was nice and comfortable. You didn't bother about it, but now you're aware of it. It's a trouble because you are now interfering with it. It's the nature of human beings that whatever they watch, they tend to interfere with. Now you can't get out of your mind now. Go swallow it. Gulp. And it was okay before. Now in meditation you've got to learn how to watch these things without interfering. So you're watching the breath and it doesn't change from when you're not watching it. You can watch the saliva and it's as comfortable as when you're not watching the saliva. You understand what we mean by being mindful but not interfering. Just knowing but not doing anything. The trouble is when people start watching the breath, they naturally get involved there. The mind is not strong enough to see how they're doing this, but the breath goes all over the place. It gets uncomfortable. It was very comfortable before, but now it ain't. Why? Because you have got involved. So you tend to learn how to just watch these things from a distance but not getting involved. Best way of being like a teacher, you just watch all you guys, but don't get involved, you can do whatever you want. And that way, you can watch and let go. Okay? Okay, so there you go. Now is the opportunity to develop your mindfulness and see if the breath becomes beautiful and life becomes beautiful. And the more beautiful your breath, the more beautiful the flowers outside, the more delicious your lunch will be. So there's something in this for you. When you're really mindful, especially when you're taking your lunch, know the old practice when you're taking your lunch, it's not just silence when you're taking your lunch. You only eat one mouthful at a time. By that I mean you can watch yourself in this lunchtime. Sometimes you've got one mouthful inside, you're chewing it. You've got another mouthful waiting on the spoon or the fork. There's another one, a third one, heaped up on the plate. And you're just looking at what you're going to have afterwards. You're at least three or four spoonfuls ahead of yourself. Now that is not being in the present moment. So this time, at lunchtime, just the spoonful in your mouth is all you're worried about. Your spoon or your fork is empty, and you haven't got something piled up ready for next. And you're certainly not looking at what's coming after even that. All your attention is what you are chewing now. Enjoy your food. And if you can do that, you're in the present moment. And you find you get more taste out of the food because your attention is what you're doing. You're enjoying the meal. And because you enjoy the meal, you're with it. All the juices are secreted in your body. You digest it better. There's actually more things in there to digest it. And then you can swallow it. And then you can think what you're going to have next. But not three or four or five spools ahead of yourself. This is next, and I'll have that, and that one over there afterwards. That is not the way to eat mindfully. Just like sometimes people already plan what they're going to do next. You don't know when I'm going to finish this talk. I might go on all morning. Ajahn Chah would sometimes do that, you know. He would sometimes keep on talking and we didn't know when he would finish. Sometimes 2 hours, 3 hours, 4 hours, 5 hours. He didn't mind missing lunch. So maybe I'll give this long talk and no one will have lunch today, and then we could be... But don't plan anything. When you start planning things in the future, you just create yourself more pain and suffering. Who knows what's going to happen next? Okay, so go. Okay, have a nice morning. And there are interviews now. That's what I'm supposed to do, aren't I? Interviews, and names are on the board. If you don't want to interview, you can cross your name out.